warm and bitter. I pulled the curtains and eased myself back on the bed and lay down. I thought my chest would rip open. When the pain dropped a notch and I could breathe again, I pulled the blanket to my chest and waited for Armand's pills to work. When I woke up, the room was darker. The slice of sky peeking between the curtains was the purple of twilight turning into night. The sheets were soaked and my head pounded. I had been dreaming again, but I couldn't remember what it had been about. My heart gave a sick lurch when I looked to Sohrab's bed and found it empty. I called his name. The sound of my voice startled me. It was disorienting, sitting in a dark hotel room, thousands of miles from home, my body broken, calling the name of a boy I had only met a few days ago. I called his name again and heard nothing. I struggled out of bed, checked the bathroom, looked in the narrow hallway outside the room. He was gone. I locked the door and hobbled to the manager's office in the lobby, one hand clutching the rail along the walkway for support. There was a fake dusty palm tree in the corner of the lobby and flying pink flamingos on the wallpaper. I found the hotel manager reading a newspaper behind the Formica top check-in counter. I described Sohrab to him and asked if he had seen him. He put down his paper and took off his reading glasses. He had greasy hair and a square-shaped little mustache speckled with gray. He smelled vaguely of some tropical fruit I could not quite recognize. "Boys, they like to run around," he said, sighing. "I have three of them. All day they are running around, troubling their mother." He fanned his face with the newspaper, staring at my jaws. "I don't think he's out running around," I said, "and we're not from here. I'm afraid he might get lost." He bobbed his head from side to side. "Then you should have kept an eye on the boy, mister." "I know," I said, "but I fell asleep, and when I woke up, he was gone." "Boys must be tended to, you know," he said. "Yes," I said, my pulse quickening. How could he be so oblivious to my apprehension? He shifted the newspaper to his other hand, resumed the fanning. "They want bicycles now."
"Who?"
"My boys," he said. "They're saying, 'Daddy, Daddy, please buy us bicycles and we will not trouble you. Please, Daddy.'" He gave a short laugh through his nose. "Bicycles. Their mother will kill me, I am swearing to you." I imagined Sohrab lying in a ditch, or in the trunk of some car, gagged and bound. I didn't want his blood on my hands. Not his, too. "Please," I said. I squinted, read his name tag on the lapel of his short-sleeved blue cotton shirt. "Mr. Fayaz, have you seen him?"
"The boy?"
I bit down. "Yes, the boy. The boy who came with me. Have you seen him or not, for God's sake?" The fanning stopped. His eyes narrowed.
"No getting smart with me, my friend. I'm not the one who lost him."
That he had a point did not stop the blood from rushing to my face.
"You're right. I'm wrong. My fault. Now, have you seen him?"
"Sorry," he said curtly. He put his glasses back on, snapped his newspaper open. "I have seen no such boy." I stood at the counter for a minute, trying not to scream. As I was exiting the lobby, he said, "Any idea where he may have wandered to?"
"No," I said.
I felt tired, tired and scared. "Does he have any interests?" he said. I saw he had folded the paper. "My boys, for example," he said, "they will do anything for American action films, especially with that Arnold Schwarzenegger." "The mosque," I said, "the big mosque." I remembered the way the mosque had jolted Sohrab from his stupor when we had driven by it, how he had leaned out of the window looking at it. "Shah Faisal?" he said.
"Yes, can you take me there?"
"Did you know it's the biggest mosque in the world?" he asked.
"No, but
the courtyard alone can fit 40,000 people.
"Can you take me there?" I said.
"It's only a kilometer from here," he said. But he was already pushing away from the counter.
I'll pay you for the ride, I said. He sighed and shook his head. Wait here. He disappeared into the back room, returned wearing another pair of eyeglasses, a set of keys in hand, and with a short, chubby woman in an orange sari trailing him. She took his seat behind the counter. I don't take your money, he said, blowing by me. I will drive you because I'm a father like you. I thought we would end up driving around the city until night fell. I saw myself calling the police, describing Sohrab to them under Fayaz's reproachful glare. I heard the officer, his voice tired and uninterested, asking his obligatory questions. And beneath the official questions, an unofficial one. Who the hell cared about another dead Afghan kid? But we found him about 100 yards from the mosque, sitting in the half-full parking lot on an island of grass. Fayaz pulled up to the island and let me out. I have to get back, he said. That's fine, we'll walk back, I said. Thank you, Mr. Fayaz, really. He leaned across the front seat when I got out. Can I say something to you? He said. Sure. In the dark of twilight, his face was just a pair of eyeglasses reflecting the fading light. The thing about you Afghanis is that, well, you people are a little reckless. I was tired and in pain. My jaws throbbed, and those damn wounds on my chest and stomach felt like barbed wire under my skin. But I started to laugh anyway. What did I... Fayaz was saying. But I was cackling by then, full-throated bursts of laughter spilling through my wired mouth. Crazy people, he said. His tires screeched when he peeled away, his taillights blinking red in the dimming light. You gave me a good scare, I said. I sat beside him, wincing with pain as I bent. He was looking at the mosque. Shah Faisal Mosque was shaped like a giant tent. Cars came and went. Worshippers dressed in white streamed in and out. We sat in silence, me leaning against the tree, Sohrab next to me, knees to his chest. We listened to the call to prayer, watched the building's hundreds of lights come on as daylight faded. The mosque sparkled like a diamond in the dark. It lit up the sky and Sohrab's face. Have you ever been to Mazar-e-Sharif? Sohrab said, his chin resting on his kneecaps. A long time ago, I don't remember it much. Father took me there when I was little, he said. Mother and Sasa came along too. Father bought me a monkey from the bazaar. Not a real one, but the kind you have to blow up. It was brown and had a bow tie. I might have had one of those when I was a kid, I said. Father took me to the Blue Mosque, Sohrab said. I remember there were so many pigeons outside the masjid, and they weren't afraid of people. They came right up to us. Sasa gave me little pieces of naan, and I fed the birds. Soon there were pigeons cooing all around me. That was fun. You must miss your parents very much, I said. I wondered if he had seen the Taliban drag his parents out into the street. I hoped he hadn't. Do you miss your parents? He asked, resting his cheek on his knees, looking up at me. Do I miss my parents? Well, I never met my mother. My father died a few years ago, and yes, I do miss him, sometimes a lot. Do you remember what he looked like? He said. I thought of Baba's thick neck, his black eyes, his unruly brown hair. Sitting on his lap had been like sitting on a pair of tree trunks. I remember what he looked like, I said. What he smelled like, too. I'm starting to forget their faces, Sohrab said. Is that bad? No, I said. Time does that. I thought of something. I looked in the front pocket of my coat and found a Polaroid snapshot of Hassan and Sohrab. Here, I said. He brought the photo to within an inch of his face. He turned it so the light from the mosque fell on it. He looked at it for a long time. I thought he might cry, but he didn't. He just held it in both hands, and traced his thumb over its surface. I thought of a line I had read somewhere, or maybe I had heard someone say it. There are a lot of children in Afghanistan, but little childhood. He stretched his hand to give it back to me. "Keep it," I said. "It's yours." "Thank you." He looked at the photo again and stowed it in the pocket of his vest. A horse-drawn cart click-clocked by in the parking lot. Little bells dangled from the horse's neck and jingled with each step. "I've been thinking a lot about mosques lately," Sohrab said. "You have? What about them?" He shrugged. "Just thinking about them." He lifted his face and looked straight at me. Now he was crying, softly, silently. "Can I ask you something, Amir Agha?"
"Of course."
"Will God," he began and choked a little, "will God put me in hell for what I did to that man?" I reached for him and he flinched. I pulled back. "Nay, of course not," I said. I wanted to pull him close and hold him, tell him the world had been unkind to him, not the other way around. His face twisted and strained to stay composed. "Father used to say it's wrong to hurt even bad people," he said, "because they don't know any better and because bad people sometimes become good." "Not always, Sohrab." He looked at me questioningly. "The man who hurt you, I knew him from many years ago," I said. "I guess you figured that out from the conversation he and I had. He tried to hurt me once when I was your age, but your father saved me. Your father was very brave, and he was always rescuing me from trouble and standing up for me. So one day, the bad man hurt your father instead. He hurt him in a very bad way, and I couldn't save your father the way he had saved me." "Why did people want to hurt my father?" Sohrab said in a wheezy little voice. "He was never mean to anyone." "You're right. Your father was a good man," I said. "But that's what I'm trying to tell you, Sohrab John, that there are bad people in this world, and sometimes bad people stay bad, and sometimes you have to stand up to them. What you did to that man is what I should have done to him all those years ago. You gave him what he deserved, and he deserved even more." "Do you think Father is disappointed in me?" he said. "I know he's not," I said. "You saved my life in Kabul. I know he is very proud of you for that." He wiped his face with the sleeve of his shirt. It burst a bubble of spittle that had formed on his lips. He buried his face in his hands and wept for a long time before he spoke again. "I miss Father and Mother too," he croaked. "And I miss Sasa and Rahim Khan Sahib. But sometimes I'm glad they're not here anymore." "Why?" I touched his arm. He drew back. "Because," he said, gasping and hitching between sobs, "because I don't want them to see me. I'm so dirty." He sucked in his breath and let it out in a long, wheezy cry. "I'm so dirty and full of sin." "You're not dirty, Sohrab," I said. "Those men," he said, "you're not dirty at all. They did things, the bad man and the other two, they did things to me. You're not dirty and you're not full of sin." I touched his arm again and he drew away. I reached again, gently, and pulled him to me. "I won't hurt you," I whispered. "I promise." He resisted a little and slackened. He let me draw him to me and rested his head on my chest. His body convulsed in my arms with each sob. A kinship exists between people who have fed from the same breast. Now, as the boy's pain soaked through my shirt, I saw that a kinship had taken root between us two. What had happened in that room with Asif had irrevocably bound us. For days, I had been looking for the right time, the right moment to ask. The question had been buzzing around in my head and keeping me up at night. I decided the moment was now, right here, right now, with the bright lights of the house of God shining on us. "Would you like to come live in America with me and my wife?" I said. He didn't answer. He sobbed into my shirt, and I led him. "Take care," the secretary said as we passed her desk. "Your boss could use some manners," I said. I expected her to roll her eyes, maybe not in that "I know everybody says that" kind of way. Instead, she lowered her voice. "Poor Ray. He hasn't been the same since his daughter died." I raised an eyebrow. "Suicide," she whispered. On the taxi ride back to the hotel, Sohrab rested his head on the window and kept staring at the passing buildings, the rows of gum trees. His breath fogged the glass, cleared, fogged it again. I waited for him to ask me about the meeting, but he didn't. On the other side of the closed bathroom door, the water was running. Since the day we had checked into the hotel, Sohrab took a long bath every night before bed. In Kabul, hot running water had been like father's, a rare commodity. Now, Sohrab spent almost an hour a night in the bath, soaking in the soap water, scrubbing. Sitting on the edge of the bed, I called Suraya. I glanced at the thin line of light under the bathroom door. "Do you feel clean yet, Sohrab?" I thought. I passed on to Suraya what Raymond Andrews had told me. "So, what do you think?" I said. "Well, we have to think he's wrong," she said. She told me she had called a few adoption agencies that arranged international adoptions. She had not yet found one that would consider doing an Afghan adoption, but she was still looking. "How are your parents taking the news?" I said. "Maudat is happy for us. You know how she feels about you, Amir. You can do no wrong in her eyes. Padar, well, as always, he's a little harder to read. He's not saying much. And you? Are you happy?" I heard her shifting the receiver to her other hand. "I think we'll be good for your nephew, but maybe he'll be good for us too." "I was thinking the same thing," I said. "I know it sounds crazy," she said, "but I find myself wondering what his favorite korma will be, his favorite subject in school. I picture myself helping him with homework." She laughed. In the bathroom, the water had stopped running. I could hear Sohrab in there, shifting in the tub, spilling water over the sides. "You're going to be great," I said. "Oh, I almost forgot. I called Coco Sharif," she said. I remembered him reciting a poem at our nikah from a scrap of hotel stationery paper. His son had held the Quran over our heads as Suraya and I had walked toward the stage, smiling at the flashing cameras. "What did he say?" I asked. "Well, he's going to stir the pot for us. He'll call some of his INS buddies," she said. "Well, that's really great news," I said. "I can't wait for you to see Sohrab." "I can't wait to see you," she said. I hung up smiling. Sohrab emerged from the bathroom a few minutes later. He had barely said a dozen words since the meeting with Raymond Andrews, and my attempts at conversation had only met with a nod or a monosyllabic reply. He climbed into bed, pulled the blanket to his chin. Within minutes, he was snoring. I wiped the circle on the fogged-up mirror and shaved with one of the hotel's old-fashioned razors, the type that opened and you slid the blade in. Then I took my own bath, lay there until the steaming hot water turned cold and my skin shriveled up. I lay there drifting, wondering, imagining. Omar Faisal was chubby, dark, had dimpled cheeks, black button eyes, and an affable gap-toothed smile. His thinning gray hair was tied back in a ponytail. He wore a brown corduroy suit with leather elbow patches and carried a worn, overstuffed briefcase. The handle was missing, so he clutched the briefcase to his chest. He was the sort of fellow who started a lot of sentences with a laugh and an unnecessary apology, like, "I'm sorry, I'll be there at 5. Laugh. When I had called him, he had insisted on coming out to meet us. "I'm sorry, the cabbies in this town are sharks," he said in perfect English, without a trace of an accent. "They smell a foreigner, they triple their fares." He pushed through the door, all smiles and apologies, wheezing a little and sweating. He wiped his brow with a handkerchief and opened his briefcase, rummaged in it for a notepad, and apologized for the sheets of paper that spilled on the bed. Sitting cross-legged on his bed, Sohrab kept one eye on the muted television, the other on the harried lawyer. I had told him in the morning that Faisal would be coming, and he had nodded, almost asked something, and had just gone on watching a show with talking animals. "Here we are," Faisal said, flipping open a yellow legal notepad. "I hope my children take after their mother when it comes to organization." "I'm sorry, probably not the sort of thing you want to hear from your prospective lawyer, eh?" He laughed. "Well, Raymond Andrews thinks highly of you." "Mr. Andrews, yes, yes, decent fellow. Actually, he rang me and told me about you."
"He did?"
"Oh, yes," he said. "So you're familiar with my situation?" Faisal dabbed at the sweat beads above his lips. "I'm familiar with the version of the situation you gave Mr. Andrews," he said. His cheeks dimpled with a coy smile. He turned to Sohrab. "This must be the young man who's causing all the trouble," he said in Farsi. "This is Sohrab," I said. "Sohrab, this is Mr. Faisal, the lawyer I told you about." Sohrab slid down the side of the bed and shook hands with Omar Faisal. "Salam alaikum," he said in a low voice.
"Alaikum salam, Sohrab," Faisal said.
"Did you know you are named after a great warrior?" Sohrab nodded. He climbed back onto his bed and lay on his side to watch TV.
"I didn't know you spoke Farsi so well," I said in English. "Did you grow up in Kabul?"
"No, I was born in Karachi," he said. "But I did live in Kabul for a number of years, short and out, near the Haji Yaqub Mosque. I grew up in Berkeley, actually. My father opened a music store there in the late 60s. Free love, headbands, tie-dye shirts, you name it." He leaned forward. "I was at Woodstock."
"Groovy," I said.
And Faisal laughed so hard he started sweating all over again. "Anyway," I continued, "what I told Mr. Andrews was pretty much it, save for a thing or two, or maybe three. I'll give you the uncensored version." He licked a finger and flipped to a blank page, uncapped his pen. "I'd appreciate that, Amir. And why don't we just keep it in English from here on out?"
"Fine," I said.
I told him everything that had happened. Told him about my meeting with Rahim Khan, the trek to Kabul, the orphanage, the stoning at Qazi Stadium.
"God," he whispered.
"I'm sorry. I have such fond memories of Kabul. Hard to believe it's the same place you're telling me about."
"Have you been there lately?" I asked.
"God, no."
"Well, it's not Berkeley, I'll tell you that," I said.
"Go on," he said.
I told him the rest. The meeting with Asif, the fight, Sohrab and his slingshot, our escape back to Pakistan. When I was done, he scribbled a few notes, breathed in deeply, and gave me a sober look.
"Well, Amir, you've got a tough battle ahead of you," he said.
"One I can win?"
He capped his pen. "At the risk of sounding like Raymond Andrews, it's not likely. Not impossible, but hardly likely." Gone was the affable smile, the playful look in his eyes. "But it's kids like Sohrab who need a home the most," I said. "These rules and regulations don't make any sense to me."
"You're preaching to the choir, Amir," he said. "But the fact is, take current immigration laws, adoption agency policies, and the political situation in Afghanistan, and the deck is stacked against you."
"I don't get it," I said. I wanted to hit something. "I mean, I get it, but I don't get it."
Omar nodded, his brow furrowed.
Well, it's like this. In the aftermath of a disaster, whether it be natural or man-made, and the Taliban are a disaster, Amir, believe me, it's always difficult to ascertain that a child is an orphan. Kids get displaced in refugee camps or parents just abandon them because they can't take care of them. Happens all the time. So the INS won't grant a visa unless it's clear the child meets the definition of an eligible orphan. I'm sorry, I know it sounds ridiculous, but you need death certificates. Well, you've been to Afghanistan, I said. You know how improbable that is. I know, he said. But let's suppose it's clear the child has no surviving parent. Even then, the INS thinks it's good adoption practice to place the child with someone in his own country so his heritage can be preserved. What heritage? I said. The Taliban have destroyed what heritage Afghans had. You saw what they did to the giant Buddhas in Bamiyan. I'm sorry, I'm telling you how the INS works, Amir, Omar said, touching my arm. He glanced at Sohrab and smiled. Turned back to me. Now, a child has to be legally adopted according to the laws and regulations of his own country. But when you have a country in turmoil, say a country like Afghanistan, government offices are busy with emergencies, and processing adoptions won't be a top priority. I sighed and rubbed my eyes. A pulsating headache was settling in just behind them. But let's suppose that somehow Afghanistan gets its act together, Omar said, crossing his arms on his protruding belly. It still may not permit this adoption. In fact, even the more moderate Muslim nations are hesitant with adoptions, because in many of those countries, Islamic law, Sharia, doesn't recognize adoption. You're telling me to give it up? I asked, pressing my palm to my forehead. I grew up in the U.S., Amir. If America taught me anything, it's that quitting is right up there with pissing in the Girl Scouts lemonade jar. But as your lawyer, I have to give you the facts, he said. Finally, adoption agencies routinely send staff members to evaluate the child's milieu, and no reasonable agency is going to send an agent to Afghanistan. I looked at Sohrab sitting on the bed, watching TV, watching us. He was sitting the way his father used to, chin resting on one knee. I'm his half-uncle. Does that count for anything? It does if you can prove it. I'm sorry, do you have any papers or anyone who can support you? No papers, I said in a tired voice. No one knew about it. Sohrab didn't know until I told him, and I myself didn't find out until recently. The only other person who knows is gone, maybe dead. Omar said. Well, what are my options, Omar? I'll be frank, you don't have a lot of them. Well, Jesus, what can I do? Omar breathed in, tapped his chin with the pen, let his breath out. Well, you could still file an orphan petition and hope for the best. You could do an independent adoption. That means you'd have to live with Sohrab here in Pakistan, day in and day out, for the next 2 years. You could seek asylum on his behalf. That's a lengthy process, and you'd have to prove political persecution. You could request a humanitarian visa. That's at the discretion of the Attorney General, and it's not easily given. He paused. There is another option. Probably your best shot. What? I said, leaning forward. You could relinquish him to an orphanage here, then file an orphan petition. Start your I-600 form and your home study while he's in a safe place. What are those? I said. I'm sorry, the I-600 is an INS formality. The home study is done by the adoption agency you choose, Omar said. It's, you know, to make sure you and your wife aren't raving lunatics. I don't want to do that, I said, looking again at Sohrab. I promised I wouldn't send him back to an orphanage. Well, like I said, it may be your best shot, Omar said. We talked a while longer. Then I walked him out to his car, an old VW Bug. The sun was setting on Islamabad by then, a flaming nimbus in the west. I watched the car tilt under Omar's weight as he somehow managed to slide in behind the wheel. He rolled down the window. Amir? Yes. I meant to tell you in there about what you're trying to do. I think it's pretty great. He waved as he pulled away, standing outside the hotel room and waving back. I wished Surayya could be there with me.
Sohrab had turned off the TV when I went back into the room. I sat on the edge of my bed and asked him to sit next to me.
Mr. Faisal thinks there's a way I can take you to America with me, I said.
He does? Sohrab said, smiling faintly for the first time in days.
When can we go?
Well, that's the thing. It might take a little while. But he said it could be done, and he's going to help us.
I put my hand on the back of his neck. From outside, the call to prayer blared through the streets.
Well, how long? Sohrab asked.
I don't know. A while. Sohrab shrugged and smiled, wider this time.
I don't mind. I can wait. It's like the sour apples.
Sour apples? I asked.
One time, when I was really little, he said, I climbed a tree and ate these green sour apples. My stomach swelled and became hard like a drum. It hurt a lot. Mother said that if I had just waited for the apples to ripen, I wouldn't have become sick. So now, whenever I really want something, I try to remember what she said about the apples.
Sour apples, I said.
Mashallah, you're just about the smartest little guy I've ever met, Sohrab Jan. His ears reddened with a blush.
Will you take me to that red bridge, the one with the fog? He said.
Absolutely, I said. Absolutely.
And we'll drive up those streets, the ones where all you see is the hood of the car and the sky?
Every single one of them, I said.
My eyes stung with tears and I blinked them away.
Is English hard to learn?
I say within a year you'll speak it as well as Farsi, I said.
Really?
Yes.
I placed a finger under his chin and turned his face up to mine.
There is one other thing, Sohrab.
What?
Well, Mr. Faisal thinks it would really help if we could ask you to stay in a home for kids for a while.
Home for kids? He said, his smile fading.
You mean an orphanage?
Well, it would only be for a little while.
No, he said.
No, please.
Sohrab, it would be for just a little while, I promise.
You promised you'd never put me in one of those places, Amir Agha, he said.
His voice was breaking, tears pooling in his eyes. I felt like a prick.
This is different. It would be here, in Islamabad, not in Kabul. And I would visit you all the time until we could get you out and take you to America.
Please, please no, he croaked. I'm scared of that place. They'll hurt me. I don't want to go.
No one is going to hurt you. Not ever again.
Yes, they will. They always say they won't, but they lie. They lie. Please, God.
I wiped the tear streaking down his cheek with my thumb.
Sour apples, remember? It's just like the sour apples, I said softly.
No, it's not. Not that place. God, oh God, please no.
He was trembling, snot and tears mixing on his face.
Shh.
I pulled him close and wrapped my arms around his shaking body.
Shh, it'll be all right. We'll go home together. You'll see, it'll be all right.
His voice was muffled against my chest, but I heard the panic in it.
Please promise you won't. Oh God, Amir Agha, please promise you won't.
How could I promise? I held him against me, held him tightly and rocked back and forth. He wept into my shirt until his tears dried, until his shaking stopped and his frantic pleas dwindled to indecipherable mumbles. I waited, rocked him until his breathing slowed and his body slackened. I remembered something I had read somewhere a long time ago. That's how children deal with terror. They fall asleep. I carried him to his bed and set him down. Then I lay in my own bed, looking out the window at the purple sky over Islamabad. The sky was a deep black when the phone jolted me from sleep. I rubbed my eyes and turned on the bedside lamp. It was a little past 10:30 p.m. I'd been sleeping for almost 3 hours. I picked up the phone.
Hello? Call from America.
Mr. Fayaz's bored voice.
Thank you, I said.
The bathroom light was on. Sohrab was taking his nightly bath. A couple of clicks and then Surayya.
Salam.
She sounded excited. "Hi," I said. "How did the meeting go with the lawyer?"
I told her what Omar Faisal had suggested.
"Well, you can forget about it," she said. "We won't have to do that." I sat up.
"Rosti? Why, what's up?"
"I heard back from Coco Sharif," she said. "He said the key was getting Sohrab into the country. Once he's in, there are ways of keeping him here. So he made a few calls to his INS friends. He called me back tonight and said he was almost certain he could get Sohrab a humanitarian visa."
"No kidding," I said. "Oh, thank God. Good old Sharif John."
"I know," she said. "Anyway, we'll serve as the sponsors. It should all happen pretty quickly. He said the visa would be good for a year. Plenty of time to apply for an adoption petition."
"It's really going to happen, Surayyo, huh?"
"It looks like it," she said. She sounded happy. I told her I loved her, and she said she loved me back. I hung up.
"Sohrab," I called, rising from my bed. "I have great news."
I knocked on the bathroom door.
"Sohrab, Surayyo John just called from California. We won't have to put you in the orphanage, Sohrab. We're going to America, you and me. Did you hear me? We're going to America."
I pushed the door open, stepped into the bathroom. Suddenly, I was on my knees, screaming. Screaming through my clenched teeth. Screaming until I thought my throat would rip and my chest explode. Later, they said I was still screaming when the ambulance arrived. Then, 4 days ago, on a cool, rainy day in March of 2002, a small, wondrous thing happened. I took Surayyo, Khala Jamila, and Sohrab to a gathering of Afghans at Lake Elizabeth Park in Fremont. The general had finally been summoned to Afghanistan the month before for a ministry position and had flown there 2 weeks earlier. He had left behind his gray suit and pocket watch. The plan was for Khala Jamila to join him in a few months once he had settled. She missed him terribly and worried about his health there, and we had insisted she stay with us for a while. The previous Thursday, the first day of spring, had been the Afghan New Year's Day, the Sol e Now, and Afghans in the Bay Area had planned celebrations throughout the East Bay and the peninsula. Kabir, Surayyo, and I had an additional reason to rejoice. Our little hospital in Rawalpindi had opened the week before. Not the surgical unit, just the pediatric clinic. But it was a good start, we all agreed. It had been sunny for days, but Sunday morning, as I swung my legs out of bed, I heard raindrops pelting the window. Afghan luck, I thought, and snickered. I prayed morning namaz while Surayyo slept. I didn't have to consult the prayer pamphlet I had obtained from the mosque anymore. The surahs came naturally now, effortlessly. We arrived around noon and found a handful of people taking cover under a large rectangular plastic sheet mounted on 6 poles spiked to the ground. Someone was already frying bologna. Steam rose from teacups and a pot of cauliflower ash. A scratchy old Ahmad Zahir song was blaring from a cassette player. I smiled a little as the four of us rushed across a soggy grass field, Surayyo and I in the lead, Khala Jamila in the middle, Sohrab behind us, the hood of his yellow raincoat bouncing on his back.
"What's so funny?" Surayyo said, holding a folded newspaper over her head.
"You can take Afghans out of Parman, but you can't take Parman out of Afghans," I said. We stooped under the makeshift tent. Surayyo and Khala Jamila drifted toward an overweight woman frying spinach bologna. Sohrab stayed under the canopy for a moment, then stepped back out into the rain, hands stuffed in the pockets of his raincoat, his hair, now brown and straight like Hassan's, plastered against his scalp. He stopped near a coffee-colored puddle and stared at it. No one seemed to notice. No one called him back in. With time, the queries about our adopted and decidedly eccentric little boy had mercifully ceased. and considering how tactless Afghan queries can be sometimes, that was a considerable relief. People stopped asking why he never spoke, why he didn't play with the other kids. And best of all, they stopped suffocating us with their exaggerated empathy, their slow head shaking, their tisk tisk, their "oh gunge bichara," "oh poor little mute one." The novelty had worn off. Like dull wallpaper, Sohrab had blended into the background. I shook hands with Kabir, a small silver-haired man. He introduced me to a dozen men, one of them a retired teacher, another an engineer, a former architect, a surgeon who was now running a hot dog stand in Hayward. They all said they had known Baba in Kabul, and they spoke about him respectfully. In one way or another, he had touched all their lives. The men said I was lucky to have had such a great man for a father. We chatted about the difficult and maybe thankless job Karzai had in front of him, about the upcoming Loya Jirga, and the king's imminent return to his homeland after 28 years of exile. I remembered the night in 1973, the night Zahir Shah's cousin overthrew him. I remembered gunfire and the sky lighting up in silver. Ali had taken me and Hassan in his arms, told us not to be afraid, that they were just shooting ducks. Then someone told a Mullah Nasruddin joke, and we were all laughing. "You know, your father was a funny man too," Kabir said. "He was, wasn't he?" I said, smiling, remembering how, soon after we arrived in the U.S., Baba started grumbling about American flies. He'd sit at the kitchen table with his fly swatter, watch the flies darting from wall to wall, buzzing here, buzzing there, harried and rushed. "In this country, even flies are pressed for time," he'd groan. How I had laughed. I smiled at the memory now. By 3 o'clock, the rain had stopped and the sky was a curdled gray burdened with lumps of clouds. A cool breeze blew through the park. More families turned up. Afghans greeted each other, hugged, kissed, exchanged food. Someone lighted coal in a barbecue, and soon the smell of garlic and morgh kebab flooded my senses. There was music, some new singer I didn't know, and the giggling of children. I saw Sohrab, still in his yellow raincoat, leaning against the garbage pail, staring across the park at the empty batting cage. A little while later, as I was chatting with the former surgeon, who told me he and Baba had been classmates in 8th grade, Soraya pulled on my sleeve. "Amir, look!" She was pointing to the sky. A half dozen kites were flying high, speckles of bright yellow, red, and green against the gray sky. "Check it out," Soraya said. And this time, she was pointing to a guy selling kites from a stand nearby. "Here, hold this," I said. I gave my cup of tea to Soraya. I excused myself and walked over to the kite stand, my shoes squishing on the wet grass. I pointed to a yellow seporcha. "Salinau Mubarak," the kite seller said, taking the 20 and handing me the kite and a wooden spool of glass tar. I thanked him and wished him a happy new year too. I tested the string the way Hassan and I used to, by holding it between my thumb and forefinger and pulling it. It reddened with blood, and the kite seller smiled. I smiled back. I took the kite to where Sohrab was standing, still leaning against the garbage pail, arms crossed on his chest. He was looking up at the sky. "Do you like the seporcha?" I said, holding up the kite by the ends of the crossbars. His eyes shifted from the sky to me, to the kite, then back. A few rivulets of rain trickled from his hair, down his face. "I read once that in Malaysia, they use kites to catch fish," I said. "I'll bet you didn't know that. They tie a fishing line to it and fly it beyond the shallow waters, so it doesn't cast a shadow and scare the fish. And in ancient China, generals used to fly kites over battlefields to send messages to their men." "It's true," I'm not slipping you a trick. I showed him my bloody thumb. Nothing wrong with the tar either. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Saraya watching us from the tent, hands tensely dug in her armpits. Unlike me, she had gradually abandoned her attempts at engaging him. The unanswered questions, the blank stares, the silence. It was all too painful. She had shifted to holding pattern, waiting for a green light from Sohrab. Waiting. I wet my index finger and held it up. I remember the way your father checked the wind was to kick up dust with his sandal and see which way the wind blew it. He knew a lot of little tricks like that, I said. I lowered my finger. West, I think. Sohrab wiped the raindrop from his earlobe and shifted on his feet. Said nothing. I thought of Saraya asking me a few months ago what his voice sounded like. I had told her I didn't remember anymore. Did I ever tell you your father was the best kite runner in Wazir Akbar Khan? Maybe all of Kabul? I said, knotting the loose end of the spool tar to the string loop tied to the center spar. How jealous he made the neighborhood kids. He'd run kites and never look up at the sky, and people used to say he was chasing the kite's shadow. But they didn't know him like I did. Your father wasn't chasing any shadows. He just knew. Another half dozen kites had taken flight. People had started to gather in clumps, teacups in hand, eyes glued to the sky. Do you want to help me fly this? I said. Sohrab's gaze bounced from the kite to me, back to the sky. Okay, I shrugged. Looks like I'll have to fly Tanhoi, solo. I balanced the spool in my left hand and fed about 3 feet of string. The yellow kite dangled at the end of it, just above the wet grass. Last chance, I said. But Sohrab was looking at a pair of kites tangling high above the trees. All right, here I go. I took off running, my sneakers splashing rainwater from puddles, the hand clutching the kite end of the string held high above my head. It had been so long, so many years since I'd done this, and I wondered if I'd make a spectacle of myself. I let the spool roll in my left hand as I ran, felt the string cut my right hand again as it fed through. The kite was lifting behind my shoulder now, lifting, wheeling, and I ran harder. The spool spun faster, and the glass string tore another gash in my right palm. I stopped and turned, looked up, smiled. High above, my kite was tilting side to side like a pendulum, making that old paper bird flapping its wings sound I always associated with winter mornings in Kabul. I hadn't flown a kite in a quarter of a century, but suddenly I was 12 again, and all the old instincts came rushing back. I felt the presence next to me and looked down. It was Sohrab, hands dug deep in the pockets of his raincoat. He had followed me. "Do you want to try?" I asked. He said nothing, but when I held the string out for him, his hand lifted from his pocket, hesitated, took the string. My heart quickened as I spun the spool to gather the loose string. We stood quietly side by side, necks bent up. Around us, kids chased each other and slid on the grass. Someone was playing an old Hindi movie soundtrack now. A line of elderly men were praying afternoon namaz on a plastic sheet spread on the ground. The air smelled of wet grass, smoke, and grilled meat. I wished time would stand still. Then I saw we had company. A green kite was closing in. I traced the string to a kid standing about 30 yards from us. He had a crew cut and a t-shirt that read, "The Rock Rules," in bold block letters. He saw me looking at him and smiled. Waved. I waved back. Sohrab was handing the string back to me. "Are you sure?" I said, taking it. He took the spool from me. "Okay," I said. "Let's give him a sabak. Teach him a lesson, eh?" I glanced over at him. The glassy, vacant look in his eyes was gone. His gaze flitted between our kite and the green one. His face was a little flushed, his eyes suddenly alert, awake, alive. I wondered when I had forgotten that, despite everything, he was still just a child. The green kite was making its move. "Let's wait," I said. "We'll let him get a little closer." It dipped twice and crept toward us.
"Come on, come to me," I said.
The green kite drew closer yet, now rising a little above us, unaware of the trap I had set for it.
"Watch, Sohrab, I'm going to show you one of your father's favorite tricks, the old lift and dive."
Next to me, Sohrab was breathing rapidly through his nose. The spool rolled in his palms, the tendons in his scarred wrists like rhubarb strings. Then I blinked, and for just a moment, the hands holding the spool were the chip-nailed, calloused hands of a hair-lipped boy. I heard a crow cawing somewhere, and I looked up. The park shimmered with snow so fresh, so dazzling white, it burned my eyes. It sprinkled soundlessly from the branches of white-clad trees. I smelled turnip korma now, dried mulberries, sour oranges, sawdust, and walnuts. The muffled quiet, snow quiet, was deafening. Then far away, across the stillness, a voice calling us home, the voice of a man who dragged his right leg. The green kite hovered directly above us now. "He's going for it, any time now," I said, my eyes flicking from Sohrab to our kite. The green kite hesitated, held position, then shot down. "Here he comes," I said. I did it perfectly. After all these years, the old lift and dive trap. I loosened my grip and tugged on the string, dipping and dodging the green kite. A series of quick sidearm jerks, and our kite shot up counterclockwise, in a half circle. Suddenly, I was on top. The green kite was scrambling now, panic-stricken. But it was too late. I had already slipped him Hassan's trick. I pulled hard, and our kite plummeted. I could almost feel our string sawing his. Almost heard the snap. And then, just like that, the green kite was spinning and wheeling out of control. Behind us, people cheered. Whistles and applause broke out. I was panting. The last time I had felt a rush like this was that day in the winter of 1975, just after I had cut the last kite, when I spotted Baba on our rooftop, clapping and beaming. I looked down at Sohrab. One corner of his mouth had curled up just so. A smile. Lopsided. Hardly there, but there. Behind us, kids were scampering, and a melee of screaming kite runners was chasing the loose kite drifting high above the trees. I blinked, and the smile was gone. But it had been there. I had seen it. "Do you want me to run that kite for you?" I asked. His Adam's apple rose and fell as he swallowed. The wind lifted his hair. I thought I saw him nod. "For you, 1,000 times over, I heard myself say. Then I turned and ran. It was only a smile, nothing more. It didn't make everything all right. It didn't make anything all right. Only a smile. A tiny thing. A leaf in the woods, shaking in the wake of a startled bird's flight. But I'll take it. With open arms. Because when spring comes, it melts the snow one flake at a time. And maybe I just witnessed the first flake melting. I ran. A grown man running with a swarm of screaming children. But I didn't care. I ran with the wind blowing in my face and a smile as wide as the valley of Panjshir
on my lips. I ran.
The Kite Runner was written and read by Khaled Hosseini. It was recorded at Annex Digital in Menlo Park, California, with editing and post-production by Common Mode, Paul Fowley, Technical Director. The mix engineer was Terry Hogan. The associate producer was Kelly Gilday. The director was Jesse Boggs. The Kite Runner was produced by Susan Perrin. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio.